The bloodshed in Gaza and the suffering of the civilian population there has been very much in the spotlight of the world's media over the past 3 weeks. But of course, there are many other trouble spots around the globe that much of the time are largely ignored by the foreign media. One such example is the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, that has been suffering from a series of civil wars and intermittent violence over the past decade that have caused the deaths of around 5 million people. The huge number of war-related fatalities make it the world's deadliest documented conflict since the Second World War. In the autumn of 2008, the plight of the Congolese people did hit the world headlines after a major escalation of violence between rebel forces and Congolese troops in North Kivu that displaced an estimated 1 million people. As I speak, diplomatic efforts are continuing in Kenya to try to find a negotiated solution to Congo's conflict. But 2 months on from that major upsurge of fighting, and with few media outlets currently dedicating much space to Congo's plight, what's the situation like for the Congolese people living in the conflict zones to the east of the country? How much are civilians suffering from the frequent outbreaks of fighting and chronic instability in North Kivu and other areas? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Alexander Bula, a freelance journalist for Caritas Internationalis, who was based in the Goma region of Congo during October and November of last year.
The situation is still insecure. It is not stable at all. My impression is that people are living through an insecure situation at the moment, which doesn't have the daily violence, maybe, but the threat is still hanging above their heads. There's still the possibility that any time a war might break loose, as last autumn.
Are many of the displaced still living in camps, or have most of the people gone back to their homes?
Those camps have existed now for several years, actually, at least some of them, like Mugunga, and they have been there since basically sometimes even 1998. So people try to go back. They try to go to areas where it has calmed down, and as it has always been as for the last 10 years in the DRC, especially eastern DRC, the war just kind of moves on. So if you are from one area and you are driven out because of the war from that area, you go to a refugee camp, if you survive that, of course. You stay in the refugee camp, then sometimes the war calms down a bit and moves on to another area, and then you go back. You try to go back to your area, but the problem is that by then, maybe your neighbors have already taken over your home and your agricultural livelihood.
Okay, you were there during the aftermath of the worst of the violence in the autumn of 2008. You were in the Goma area. How would you describe the morale, the mood of the people you came across there, particularly the displaced people and those who had been most affected by the fighting?
The displaced people were really shocked, traumatized. Many women had been, of course, raped. The families had been driven out of their homes. They had lost everything. Many people I spoke to, they just had one set of clothes, just the clothes they had on their body. There wasn't anything else they had. They came into the refugee camps. Everything had to be given to them. Sometimes some refugee camps couldn't be provided with anything at all. It was a total disaster. So people were really deeply traumatized. But still, it's always fascinating to see how their morale, they still try to go on and try to survive and do everything for that. And that is deeply fascinating and moving, actually.
And what were conditions like in the camps that you saw? Can you paint us a brief picture?
Well, there were different kinds of camps, actually. So we have the camps that have been set up since 1998, like Mugunga. And in Mugunga, you have toilets. You have tents with about 4 to 6 square meters where a whole family tries to live in, tries to cook. But there are other camps I've seen in the town, for example, and they didn't receive any help at all. And they were expanding like mad. Beginning, you had 1,000 people that went there, and then from 1 week to the other, you had 1,800 people that were suddenly living there with no food, very limited amount of toilets. So that was really, really very drastic, very stressful for all.
And how badly nourished were some of the people you came into contact with? Did you see people who were, you know, visibly suffering from malnutrition, children, for instance?
Well, with the children, it was very easily to see because many children were sick. When the families were forced to leave their homes, they had to march sometimes for days. And an adult can endure that, but a child doesn't have the capacity actually to do that. And so children were mostly suffering from that. I saw many sick children, and the problem with malnutrition is not only that it's just malnutrition, but they catch malaria and several other sicknesses.
You mentioned earlier that many of the women had been raped, and it's often been claimed that rape has become endemic in the conflict zones of Congo and has been used for decades as a weapon of war. Was this borne out, confirmed by what you saw and heard during your time in the Goma area?
Well, if you look at, in the DRC, in Eastern Congo especially, rape is a means of war, and to saying this awful truth, rather in Southern Kivu. There, some rebel movements rape women, trying to break up the whole family, because once a woman is raped, the whole family tries to get rid of her, tries to dump her, and the villages break apart. So that is what some of these rebel movements are trying to do. But that hasn't happened in Northern Kivu. In Northern Kivu, it is as awful as it sounds. It is just one thing the soldiers and the rebels do. It is not systematic. Whereas in the Southern Kivu, it is really a means of trying to destroy this region.
Can you share with us and our listeners any particularly poignant or shocking story of a Congolese person that you came into contact with that somehow sums up the plight of these people?
Well, maybe the story of a child soldier I met in Goma, in Don Bosco. So this 11-year-old boy, he was in the Masisi region, living with his parents, and on Sunday we went to church, and when he returned, he saw that the rebels, the FDLR rebels, they had been pillaging his village, and they immediately kidnapped him, and he was 11 at that time, and made him carry their ammunition, their guns, which is a normal way in which you make many child soldiers. There's reckoned that you have about, I think, 30,000 child soldiers in all of DRC. So he was made to walk with them. He went to a kind of shooting training. And at the end of the shooting training, there was kind of an exam. And the kids that didn't pass it were shot by the commander of this rebel troop. But our child soldier had the luck of being able to shoot very good. So he passed the exam and wasn't shot. In fact, he was the personal favorite of this colonel. But to make him a loyal soldier, to break him totally, he had then later on to shoot child soldiers that didn't pass the shooting exam himself. And he was so good that he participated in several attacks with not only with AK-47, so with rifles, but also with RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades. So he was a good soldier with his 11, 12 years. But he had the luck that the wife of the rebel commander really liked him. And when they traveled, he finally spoke to her and came up with that he wanted to leave the soldiers, and she agreed with him, so gave him money to leave the soldiers, and then he ran off, went to a home of the Caritas in Eastern Congo, and stayed there for a certain time, where they tried to reintegrate him into society, to show him what a normal life can be. But then the war moved to that zone too. He had to be evacuated, come back to Goma, and now he's sitting in Goma, waiting for a paper that shows that he's not a child soldier anymore, that confirms it, which he can then again show to the other rebels that now occupy his home area, so that they don't shoot him, thinking that he is a spy for the other rebels. This is not daily life in DRC, but it's very close to it. It is a very, very complicated life they live.
It's widely believed that one of the things that is helping to fuel the conflict in the DRC is the competition and the plundering of the country's rich natural resources by many outside players, including many Western mining companies. Are many of the Congolese people aware of this fact? And if so, do they feel angry with the West, particularly that it's not doing perhaps more to try to stop this plundering?
The Congolese are very angry, actually, with the West. They claim the West to be still imperialistic. They claimed the West to be the cause of all misery. But at the same time, they tend to overlook their own people's fault in the whole play. Because corruption, or let's start with the MONUC. The MONUC, which is the UN troop for the UN peacekeeping troop for Eastern DRC, or for DRC, they has been thrown at with stones because people are so angry that they don't double their efforts to keep the peace in the country. But the problem is the MONUC can't do it, obviously, alone. Many Congolese tend to overlook that the corruption is really endemic. They just tend to overlook it. They just don't see how their own people pillage the country. Even if they see it, they are so frustrated by their own people, by their own elite, that they just say, well, yeah, we can't count on them, so it has to be the foreigners. And if we can't count on them, whom are we going to count on? So it's a feeling of desperation at the same time. They have the feeling that everybody is trying to plunder them and their country.
I was speaking there to Alexander Bühler, a freelance journalist for Caritas Internationalis,